We are back on the Bengals Beat podcast. I'm Lindsay Patterson, Tyler Dragon, Charlie Goldsmith. How you guys doing?
So I'm like you this week. I'm at an undisclosed location for a quick little vacation. I'm not in Cincinnati, but I'm going to be like you, Lindsay, and not reveal where I am in the United States of America. I can say it's not a beach city.
I'm in Cincinnati. Hello. It snowed yesterday, but like it didn't really snow downtown, but it snowed in other parts of the city. It only snowed kind of to affect the Reds game on Tuesday. So it's kind of been a wild week around here.
I can't believe it snowed in April. That is just beyond me. In April, that's crazy to me.
It's Cincinnati weather. That's just what happens. I'm used to it. And then it's going to be 80 degrees on Monday. Totally normal. I actually want to get to this. I'm backing it up a couple days because Charlie and I had a chance to go down to Paul Brown Stadium for the new uniforms. I know there was a leak back in March. And Tyler, I know you've had a chance to hear some of the interviews and get your own look at the new unis. What did you guys think?
Well, that was part of my question of the week. So thanks for ruining it. But I thought, you know, the uniforms, they're a nice look. They're a nod to some of the old school ones. I like the touch with Paul Brown's signature on the collar inside. I like the all white unis and the all black ones. Those are my favorite. But yeah, I thought they did a good job with the new uniforms.
Here's my take. New stripes has been said a lot since January, but now I actually finally get it. When I saw the new uniforms, I realized that the word Cincinnati and the word Bengals on the front of the jersey are very small, and the stripes really in a lot of ways speak for themselves, specifically the helmet stripes, but also the ones on the shoulders and the pants. Those are as much of the identifying factor as the Cincinnati or the Bengals, probably even more visible than the Cincinnati or the Bengals. So new stripes, the Bengals are the stripes. That is their logo almost. Even though, of course, they still have the B, that is how you will recognize them. And they really lean into that with these new uniforms.
Yeah, you know, getting a chance to look at them and then the overall fan reaction, you guys know on social media, rarely do fans agree with a new look. And I feel like it was 70 to 30 nationally. They didn't really see a huge difference. But I think when you compare the past uniforms to the ones that they have out now, they're totally different. They're clean, they're simple. And as you mentioned, Tyler, with the signature of Paul Brown, that was actually a question that was brought up at the jersey reveal. And they said that Nike presented that to them and thought, hey, let's put this on the back. It's really subtle and it's just different. It makes the uniforms something that they've never done before. I did ask Elizabeth Blackburn, though, because I know a lot of people love a throwback uniform. I asked if that would be an option because they get four different alternates. And she said that is, they're aware of it. She didn't want to give us any answers, but they're aware of it. That could be a possibility for the future. But I do. I think they look clean and different than the past unis. But going on to Joe Burrow, first time we actually heard from Burrow was on a podcast with Chris Collinsworth, former Bengals wide receiver on the Pro Football Focus podcast. And he talked a lot. He had a lot to say, started with his head coach's relationship, him in his first year, rookie year in the NFL. What were some of your guys' biggest takeaways from that interview with Chris?
Well, I was kind of mad that Joe Burrow didn't come on our podcast first. I'm just joking. My biggest takeaway from that was Joe Burrow really doubled down that he expects to be in the field and start week one. That was the biggest news of the podcast, in my opinion. And he updated us, very vaguely on his rehab, said it's, you know, going well and it still is on pace. So those were the two biggest takeaway. Well, I guess it's just one, just an update on his, just rehab and his confidence and optimism that he is going to be on the field. Like I said in many stories before in this whole time, that his injury is a 9 to 12 month recovery process. So if he's back week one, that puts him on the short end of the timeline, around roughly 9 months. So that just means that his rehab, there's would be no hiccups, and he's obviously a quick healer from his December 2nd left knee surgery. So those, that was my takeaway. And also he was very, you know, complimentary of Zach Taylor. That's pretty much in line with what we've been hearing this offseason. Mike Daniels, he was on the Jim Rome show and said, you know, he's pretty much loves Zach Taylor and is an awesome coach. Joe Burrow said the same thing. So he echoed those same sentiments. He's known as a player's coach, and he, you know, really tries to get along with everybody in the locker room, and they just want to be in the same page. And I think that is really important, especially when you have a quarterback who you think is a franchise quarterback. So with Joe Burrow and Zach Taylor on the same page, that is, you know, a vote of confidence for Zach Taylor specifically, because you always want your key players to be in the same page as if you're a head coach. And from what Joe Burrow says, that they're, those two are on the same page. And so that's a really a good sign for Zach Taylor and his long-term future in Cincinnati. Of course, you got to start winning on the field, but if you have an endorsement from the player who you believe is your franchise quarterback, as well as Tyler Boyd, T. Higgins, you know, Sam Hubbard, Jesse Bates, you know, I could go on and on, Joe Mixon, that is a vote of confidence for your head coach, and that gives him a longer leash, even if the Bengals continue to have a couple losing seasons, as long as there's progress.
The borrow quote from Marvin Lewis, I see better than I hear. And with Joe Burrow, I saw probably the most interesting part of this rehab process with the knee scar. It was actually probably the first ACL scar I've ever seen personally. And just the fact that he was confident enough of the way it looked and where he's at to even post that photo in the first place said something to me just about his overall confidence and comfort. And while it doesn't show where he's at in the recovery process, it shows that he's aware that it is a process, that he's going through it, and that he's comfortable enough with where he's at to, I guess, show what it looks like behind the scenes with the way his knee looks.
I think during that interview when he was with Chris, obviously we've heard him talk about Zach Taylor plenty of times. Of course, he wants to be ready for week one to be determined. He did state that, look, there could be setbacks, but as of now, he's on pace to be there for the regular season start. I think one of my biggest takeaways from it, and something that I feel like we forget in those first 10 games, is really how the offense started to look. And I think the Tennessee game is one that really comes to mind. And then Washington, prior to his injury, he even said it. He said, we were starting to roll. I felt comfortable. I got hurt in the Washington game. They were the number one pass defense in the league, and we had over 200 yards passing at halftime. And I think that's one of the biggest things. You go back to what the offense was able to do when they were playing a little musical chairs with their offensive line when they had to deal with injuries. He even mentioned it. Quentin Spain off the street, he starts in that game, which is being at Paul Brown Stadium a few hours prior. So I think that is the biggest thing. You look back on this season, of course, everything is going to point to the offensive line and Joe Burrow's injury, but the offense was clicking. I mean, Joe Burrow looked like he belonged in there, you know, and that was something that he stated he really felt more comfortable with it. And obviously one of the biggest takeaways in the season, when you look at the negatives, is the deep ball. And I kind of know a receiver that could probably help with that.
Lindsay's all on board with the team Jamar Chase. She's all in.
I thought you were talking about De'Ami Brown.
You can make a case. I'm just saying, you know, just another third receiver out there. But I think, honestly, that was my biggest takeaway, is I think that was forgettable. And obviously people know Joe Burrow had a good start to his rookie year, but you look back at those last few games prior to the injury and Joe looked comfortable out there. I know it's easy to point at the AFC North games against the Pittsburgh Steelers, Baltimore Ravens, but he looked like, hey, I get this. And we had injuries, and he mentioned it. He didn't throw his offensive line under the bus or anything like that. But I think in the Washington game, that was forgettable of what happened in the first half, because obviously everybody forgot about that when he got injured.
Yeah, I remember that Washington game. I was there, and they looked like the better team on the field that day prior to Joe Burrow's injury. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, yeah, they were up. But then when Joe Burrow got injured, they didn't score for the rest of the game. And, you know, prior to that injury, they looked they were noticeably looked like the better team. And as we saw, Washington ended up in the playoffs and lost to the eventual Super Bowl champion, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But for them to be in that game, winning that game, and then when Joe Burrow got injured, they were all shell-shocked, and rightfully so. They ended up not even scoring a point again. But to your point, they did look like a like their offense was clicking, and that was coming off a game where they beat the Tennessee Titans, which before the Pittsburgh game, that was Zach Taylor's signature win. So, and that was Joe Burrow's probably best win as well in the season. So yeah, he looked more comfortable, and that's what you expect from a young quarterback. As you continue to play, the game slows down a little bit. You notice, you know, trends and defenses, and you just get more comfortable, and that comes with repetition in practice and repetition in games. And he was starting to look a lot more comfortable. And so you would hope for Bengals fans and for the Bengals organization that he continues on that trend in year two. And sometimes I do have to admit, year two, that it can be a little bit tougher for any quarterback or any player, because teams have more film on you and they take a look at your tendencies and see, okay, what does this player not like to do? And they try to force you in those situations. So he has to look out for that, as well as all second year players. I will say that for anybody. So that needs to be something that he has to be aware of, that teams are going to force him to try to throw the deep ball, and they're going to play bump and run more often. They're going to force him to see if his knee is all the way healthy. So he's going to have to, and he knows that, he's smart enough to know that. So he has to look out for that in year two.
We saw many different versions of the Bengals offense. It probably was at its best against Cleveland and against Tennessee. But aside from that, there were different versions, different little things that didn't have enough time to, I guess, become trends, obviously, with Joe Burrow's injury. But like against Washington, it was the red zone offense. Against Philadelphia, it was the ability to contain extended plays without letting them kind of spin out of control. There are still little things that like that, and crucial things like that, that even though the offense was starting to find its rhythm, need to be addressed. That, of course, brings us to the NFL draft. What are the best additions the Bengals can make to address the flaws that the Bengals offense had, even when it was at its stronger points this season?
Yeah, I think when you can talk to teammates of guys, there's a perspective there that that you don't have access to. And so we try to take advantage of that the best we can. And, you know, a lot of these guys have close relationships with some of these players. And so we use every source we can. It's no different than talking to his high school coach or his college coach or the coordinator or the head coach or the trainer or the strength and conditioning guy. We try to talk to as many people that know the guy and come to a consensus on him, and teammates fit into that mold for sure.
Speaking of injuries, your quarterback said that he's still optimistic about playing week one. Are you optimistic that he'll be available for the season opener? And how is his rehab going, your estimation?
Yeah, I'm with Joe. If he's optimistic, I'm optimistic. That's Joe. And that's our expectation, too. And I haven't been close to the rehab. I've been grinding away in the draft room. But when I've seen him, I've been impressed with where he is and how he's working, and what he says, I believe. And that's certainly our expectation too. You know, he checks the boxes for a motivated player, and one that loves the competition and loves competing, and will do what it takes to put himself in that position.
One last question. Speaking of Joe, how much is he lobbying for Ja'Marr Chase? Is he?
I haven't heard a lobby. Again, I've been head down in my draft room. Joe is aware of the players that we have in front of us. I think he's on board with anybody we choose, from that group. And there is no active lobby for any one or the other. I do think he is aware of the universe and is on board with anybody we choose from that universe. And that's a good thing. I've said it before, we're going to do what we think is best to make Joe as successful as he can be. Because the more successful Joe is, the more successful the Bengals will be. But the expectation is always to win. And that's his expectation. That's mine. And it'd be everybody's in the organization. And so we'll take the guy that we'll think will help us achieve that.
We had a chance to hear from Duke Tobin yesterday, and look, he's not going to tell you the direction the team is going with the fifth pick, and he's listening. He opened up and said they're listening to offers if there's a chance that they move down in the draft, or if they're going to get Penei or Ja'Marr Chase, to be determined on where they go. But one of my biggest takeaways from listening to Duke Tobin yesterday was – like giving Joe a chance to be in the room to decide. And he said some of the players in the room, obviously they're friends with some of the draft prospects, so they're going to talk to them. It doesn't hurt to do extra homework when it comes to who you draft in the first round. But it just seemed, after talking to him and listening to him talk, he believes in what Joe has to say.
So I will say he believes in what Joe has to say. Does Joe have the keys? I wouldn't go that far, but I do think it is important. The quarterback position is such a, important position in the NFL, and it has a huge effect on a game. We all know that. So anytime you believe you have a franchise quarterback, his opinion on things matter, as well as all other star players that you have on a team that you trust. And so Tobin did indicate that he talked to Burrow about the team's draft board, and Burrow is not lobbying for Ja'Marr Chase or Penei Sewell or anybody else, but they did have a conversation, and probably multiple conversations, about, the direction and what they're thinking and their draft philosophy. And Joe Burrow is on board with that, and he trusts what the Bengals, their decision makers, are going to do. And I believe Duke Tobin talked to probably Tyler Boyd and probably talked to Jesse Bates, Sam Hubbard. We didn't ask him about that, but I'm pretty sure he talked to, some of the key players on the Bengals team, just to, gauge and see where they're at and what they think the team's most biggest needs are. Now, do they have the final decision? No. But a quarterback like Joe Burrow, he is one of those cornerstone franchise players in the Bengals organization that they're going to ask, advice, but seek an opinion from, because his opinion, yes, does matter. And they believe that he is their franchise quarterback, and they want to make him happy. They don't want a situation where he is unhappy and turns into the whole Carson Palmer. I know those are words Cincinnati fans don't want me to say, but they want to make sure they keep him happy. And part of keeping him happy is keeping him healthy and keeping that offensive line, stabilized. But that's a conversation for another day.
My big takeaway from yesterday is kind of the two tracks of balancing the best potential starting 22 the Bengals could put out week one this season with, say, using the fifth pick for the best overall long-term piece. I do think there's a difference there, and I've started to realize that more over the last week, specifically when you look at how the Bengals view the guard position. Yesterday, Duke Tobin said, we're going to take someone at five that the Bengals think really can make a big impact this year, and Sewell could definitely do that at guard, but that's not the position the Bengals have gone all in at over the course of recent history. On top of that, you look at obviously what Ja'Marr Chase brings as well. It's such an interesting parallel, because the only person you hope is, or not you hope, the only person that the Bengals need to be around for the next 10, 5, 10, 20 years is Joe Burrow. It's all building around him, and that's where his voice comes into play. But there's just so many different dynamics on the table.
I've said it plenty of times, you guys. Well, we're a week out from the NFL draft right now, and obviously everybody brings up a good point when they say Penei Sewell, if they decide to go that route when it comes to the offensive line. I know, sound like a broken record when I say I feel like the offensive line class is really deep, and I feel like they can get a starter to potentially just slide in at guard and maybe take over the Riley Reiff position if they move on from him next season at the tackle side. I still feel they go wide receiver with Ja'Marr Chase. And I know there's this comparison game. A lot of people say, you remember the last time they drafted a receiver in the first round? You look at John Ross. John Ross did not have Ja'Marr Chase grades in the first round. A lot of people felt like the Bengals reached when it came to that decision when they picked John Ross. But I think under Zach Taylor, when you think of his offensive mind, obviously their offensive line is not done. They still need to add another piece of guard. I still feel that way. I know they have Xavier. I know they have Quentin Spain, but they're not automatic starters when it comes to week one. Under Zach Taylor, Next Gen Stats, the Bengals offense featured 3+ wide receivers on 82% of the plays in 2020. That's the second highest rate in the NFL. And you get Tyler Boyd, T. Higgins, Ja'Marr Chase under contract through at least 2023. That's a game changer for an offense.
Yes, I agree with that. I think Ja'Marr Chase has the ability to be an exceptional NFL wide receiver and a multi-time Pro Bowler. However, you have to have your quarterback standing upright to throw him the ball. So, I agree with you. Now, I will say, and I've said this multiple times, many people have told me that the Bengals are targeting Ja'Marr Chase with the 5th pick. And I didn't use sources, but I can use sources, but yes. So I believe that the Bengals are going to draft him. Do I agree? And I've said this multiple times. No, I think the Bengals should draft an offensive lineman with the number 5 pick. Can they get a starter in the 2nd or 3rd round? Maybe. I think people are overselling how deep the draft is at starting caliber offense alignment. Same as receiver. I don't think the Bengals can draft a starting caliber wide receiver in the 2nd round. So that leads me to the point where, okay, which position is the biggest position of need? And in my opinion, the offensive line is a bigger problem than receiver. And that's in the short term and long term. And it's funny because, you know, I've been a guest on the radio a lot this month because NFL draft, whether it's Fox Sports, SiriusXM, or NFL cities across the country. And then when they ask me, okay, what do you think the Bengals are going to do with the number 5 pick? Are they good? They have to go offensive lineman, right? And I'm like, well, no. And they're all shocked. They're like, what? Wait, what? Joe Burrow was just saying, I was like, well, I mean, if it were me, I would draft an offensive lineman. But I have been hearing that they're targeting Ja'Marr Chase, which I don't blame them. Ja'Marr Chase was a dynamic wide receiver in college, the best wide receiver in college football in 2019. So I can see why the Bengals want to get him. But to me, that's not their biggest need.
Now, Tyler and I are on the same page, and the Ja'Marr Chase possibility, if you want to go down that rabbit hole in that scenario, creates a fascinating possibility in the 2nd and 3rd round, because the Bengals still need one, but really multiple offensive linemen. If you take a wide receiver at 5, you lose the opportunity to take the 2 linemen in this class who can be great guards now and have the potential to be standout Pro Bowl caliber offensive tackles later. In the 2nd and 3rd round, you lose the opportunity to get 2 guys in Sewell and Slater that can be one of the better guards in the NFL right now and develop with that upside down the road. Once you get to the 2nd and 3rd round, you start turning to guys who, A, can play guard and tackle now, but don't have the same exciting tools upside of some of the other tackles in this process, in this draft. Or B, you can just take a guard who maybe has more upside on the interior offensive line, but obviously won't be able to play outside because of, you know, the position they play. You can't get all the things you want in the 2nd and 3rd round with the guard. You probably end up having, with the 2nd and 3rd round at guard and tackle, you probably end up having to take multiple offensive linemen to do 2 different things instead of just taking one at 5. So there's such a huge trade-off and such a huge opportunity cost. Maybe the Bengals are willing to take that, but taking a wide receiver does a lot. It's very important for the offense, but it does then in a lot of ways handicap the offensive line you end up going into the 2021 season with.
And all of those are good points. And as you guys mentioned, they do need to add to their offensive line. And I still see them doing that. I think if you can get a guy like Kevin Zeitler, a guy who can step in, be a starter right away, make an impact and be in this league for a long time, that's where you hope to go in the 2nd and maybe even 3rd round. I still feel like 3rd round's a question mark, because I feel like if they do have their edge guy on the board that they go defense on the 3rd round, but if they can find 2 back-to-back offensive linemen who can come in and look, there's going to be a difference from who you pick in the 2nd or 3rd round to what you could get in Penei Sewell. I totally understand that. But at the same time, I just feel like the writing's on the wall right now. It's Ja'Marr Chase and it's all but official at five.
Here's the thing though. Kevin Zeitler was the 27th pick in the NFL draft. The only interior offensive lineman who's kind of in the range the Bengals are looking at in the second round right now is Landon Dickerson from Alabama. He's a center one and two, they're just different concerns with him as well, even though he's a very athletic and explosive lineman. Aside from that, you might, if you really want to get a guard in the second round, say the next Kevin Zeitler, you might have to draft a tackle and hope that you can teach him to play guard in time for the start of the regular season. Or then you wait until the third or fourth round, unless you want to reach in the second on a guy like Trey Smith or Wyatt Davis or Josh Myers. The options there aren't as strong as Kevin Zeitler in the first place. It's just a harder, it's a harder needle to thread to, I guess, find the next Kevin Zeitler in the second round.
So I will say this. There is a belief that Alex Leatherwood could be available in the second round. And he was a standout tackle at Alabama, but his sophomore season, he did play guard. So he has some guard ability and he would be comfortable moving in the guard. And he's a good player and a starting caliber offensive lineman that could be available in round two, but he could be off the board late in round one as well. So he's a starter that I can see that could be available when the Bengals are up in round two. And I actually have the team selecting him in my mock draft that's on Cincinnati.com. So if they get him in the second round and then, of course, draft Ja'Marr Chase in the first round, that would be a great draft for the Cincinnati Bengals, especially with the first two picks. And I'm not even counting who else they can get in round three, four, and later. But if they got those two players in their first two picks, Bengals fans should be very pleased, because I do think Alex Leatherwood is one of the top linemen in the draft who could actually be available in round two.
Yeah, so here's where I'm at with Leatherwood. He is kind of in that second group of players that I was discussing earlier. He's someone who can play guard now and can play tackle later, but doesn't have the same tools and the same upside as a player like, say, Walker Little or Sam Cosmi, two players who probably wouldn't project to be guards right now. I think that one of those two players could be, say, more likely to challenge Riley Reiff for, say, the starting offensive tackle spot in 2022 than Leatherwood potentially could be. Leatherwood has a ton of snaps. He has a ton of game reps. He has an Outland trophy. But just in general, when you watch him, he doesn't have the same punch and explosiveness and fluidity that some of the other tackles in this class have. Those are traits, specifically the physical traits, the Bengals really love from the offensive tackles they bring in. And while Leatherwood is probably a more well-rounded package right now, I'm not sure he's the future in terms of him being, say, a top 10 offensive lineman in this league, which is what the Bengals need to find at some point, whether that's Jonah Williams or whoever they pick in the second round. I don't necessarily see that same upside with Leatherwood, even though he can play guard now, and that's what makes him an interesting option.
I'm playing the what-if game right now. Say they get their tackle or guard in the second round, a starter who plays right away. You get Riley Reiff for possibly 1 year at tackle. You got Jonah Williams back, center to be determined if Trey Hopkins is ready to go week one, but Billy Price is the backup as of now. You get Quentin Spain in his natural spot at left guard. Are you putting the tackle or guard you drafted into that right guard spot?
I mean, it all depends who I'm drafting. I think that's an impossible.
I'm playing a what if game. So we were going to talk about if they got Penei, where was he going to play? Where were you going to slide him in?
I'm putting Penei at a tackle because he's better than any tackle the Bengals have.
then you're putting Jonah Williams at guard, or what are you doing with Riley Reiff? Like, I just, there's so many possibilities with the offensive line and what they do if they don't go Penei Sewell with the number five pick and they go in the second round.
So if I draft Penei Sewell, I'm having a conversation with Jonah Williams and Riley Reiff about a guard spot. And it's still up in the air who I would put at guard, but Riley Reiff only signed a 1-year deal. So eventually I'm going to have Jonah Williams at right tackle. So if it were me, I would be more inclined to have Riley Reiff play a guard spot because my two tackles of the future are Jonah Williams and Penei Sewell. And that's those are the tackles that I have signed for multi-year deals. So those will be my two tackles. That's how I would do things. But I'm not the Bengals. I just report for them.
So, you know, what I loved about doing this NFL draft guide process for the offensive line class, not wide receivers coming out later this week, but here are the offensive linemen who can play guard now and tackle later who the Bengals could take in the second round. There are three of them. Leatherwood from Alabama, Liam Eichenberg from Notre Dame, Jackson Carmen from Clemson. But put a little asterisk by Carmen because he's also lost weight, according to a source during this pre-draft process, to prepare to play tackle. He's also a Cincinnati native, by the way. But if the Bengals want that type of player, they have three options. Now, I don't think any of them would be one of the best tackles of the future the Bengals could get in their spot in the second round. So it's such a difficult needle to thread. Do you, as a franchise who historically doesn't put a ton of resources into offensive guards, do you really value that guard position in the second round and get the best starting five you can get this year? Do you value tackle down the road looking for Riley Reiff's replacement? Obviously, what I would do is just get someone in the first round who can address both. I agree with Tyler, play Sewell at tackle, actually, and slide in Reiff to guard. But if that's not the route you go down, it limits your options towards where maybe Leatherwood, Eichenberg, and Carmen are the only players you can select. Get the best possible offensive line coming into next season.
I'll say this. This won't help my argument, but 60% of the first-round offensive linemen are high-impact, get rewarded with a second contract compared to 27% of wide receivers. So the Bengals probably should go offensive line, but I don't think they're going to.
We know your team, Jamar Chase, and they're letting you have – a huge backing where a lot of people are team Jamar Chase. And I get it. He's I think going to be a really good NFL wide receiver. So I would not fault the Bengals or bash them if they did draft Jamar Chase, because again, wide receiver is a position of need for the Bengals. Charlie and I and some others just believe that it's not the biggest position of need, and you can get a really good player in the offensive line with that number five pick that can hopefully help you stabilize the line for years to come and protect your franchise quarterback and also help the running game that's been pretty bad the last few years.
And I'll say this, Hall of Famer Anthony Munoz and one of the best in the booth, Dan Hoerter, are all team souls. So to be determined, we had a week.
Don't forget Ken Anderson.
Ken Anderson should be a Hall of Famer. I didn't think, looking back when they had that number five pick, that we would have this much to talk about as we are a week out, but plenty of content coming to Cincinnati.com. We'll get to that in just a moment, but go ahead, Tyler, with your questions of the week.
Okay. Well, you kind of ruined my uniform question, but I kind of tweaked it a little bit so it can still be a question of the week. So USA Today, our parent company, ranked the Bengals uniforms number 17 in the NFL, and it's an updated list, and it's the Bengals' new uniforms. Do you agree with USA Today's uniform power rankings? Are Bengals probably the middle of the pack in the uniform ranking?
I mean, that was the first uniform reveal I've gone to, so I don't know. I haven't ranked uniforms like I've ranked offensive linemen. So,
yeah, I mean, I'd say like right in the middle. I think the like new uniforms are sharp looking. I'll say they're better than what they had over the last 17 years. I actually like them. I think just making it simple is better instead of busy. And that's where they really went with this 2021 uniform. I found it pretty fascinating that it takes almost 3 years to finish the jersey design. So I know a lot of people were like, the Burrow factor or anything like that, they decided to get new uniforms the year after drafting him. They actually thought about this a while back. So I actually like them. I guess I'd put them a little outside of top 10, but I'm not really ranking and comparing a lot of uniforms. Like I told you, I like the Colts. I like the white on white. That's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. It's boring, but I like it.
Okay. So my second question of the week, we all know the NFL draft is going to be hosted in the city of Cleveland, right up the road from Cincinnati. If you got to decide a host city for the NFL draft, which city would it be? And if you choose Cincinnati, you have to pick an exact location where the draft.
There's an obvious answer for me. I miss Radio City Music Hall in New York. There was something so iconic about it. Something so, it's obviously a center stage, one of the most famous stages in the world. And it fit the event so well. I'd gotten so used to seeing it. And even the Jets fans who were there had become just a part of the experience for me. I really do miss it. And I wish it would come back there every year.
Yeah. Charlie does have a good point. I'm going to go off the beaten path a little bit. And I know it will be really expensive to do this, but the Pro Bowl used to be in Hawaii and the NFL kind of moved away from Hawaii. So what about an NFL draft at least 1 year in Hawaii? I think the players will like that. And as a journalist, if they flew me out, I wouldn't say no to Hawaii.
Really quick before we wrap this up, there is a promo going on about the draft being in Cleveland, and some people are saying in the promo that Cleveland is the greatest city in Ohio.
Well, you two are the Ohio natives, so I will reserve this question and this debate for you two, because I'm not as familiar with the entire state as you two. So you two battle it out if you two disagree. I want to hear your two takes on Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus. You can throw Athens in there. So which city is the best in Ohio in your and you two's opinions? And don't be biased. Be honest.
Does Cleveland have any notable qualities even? It's Cleveland. I just don't know what you're bringing to the table here. Like, if Cleveland had a show and tell, it would bring the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but... You know, I made one trip to Cleveland. I went there and honestly was a trip to the Reds Hall of Fame is more interesting to me than the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It didn't do much for me. And aside from that, I just don't think Cleveland brings anything else at all to the table personally.
Wow. Charlie coming with the fire. Okay, Lindsay, go ahead.
Yeah, I wouldn't put Cleveland in my top five, maybe one. I just
okay. No. You have to name your top 10 then, because like I would put Cleveland in my top 10 in Ohio. Now,
I don't think I can name 10 cities in Ohio. So yeah,
that's actually a good point. I just wouldn't put them in my top. They had the Cavs, but nobody really cares about the Cavs anymore now that LeBron is gone. Cleveland Browns, I guess, are playing better. But I'm just here to say, and this is not even just like, oh, Cincinnati is the greatest city ever. Cleveland is not the greatest city in Ohio.
So both of you two have Cincinnati over Cleveland. I take it.
100%.
Okay.
I'm now looking forward to my road trip to Cleveland for the Red Series against the Cleveland baseball team in May. So now I'll have maybe people in my Twitter mentions will be telling me how to have a good time in Cleveland after this conversation.
Is Cincinnati your favorite city in Ohio? You guys are going to get killed, by the way, wherever you answer. So I'm glad I'm out of this debate. So I'm asking you to.
I'm just here to say that Cleveland is not the greatest city in Ohio.
Okay, no. Okay, so is Cincinnati the best city in Ohio?
I'll tell a story here.
You guys are both dodging the question.
No, I'll tell a story here. So there's my dad loves this quote. There's a TV show, I think, called MASH. It's a very old show that's before my time. No offense if it's a contemporary show to any of our listeners. But there's some guy, and I think he's like stuck in a ditch or something with some girl. And he just keeps talking about Toledo, Toledo, Toledo. And the girl says, man, what do you love about Toledo so much? And he goes, what do you mean? It's my hometown. And there's something romantic about your hometown. So I'm going to be biased no matter what my hometown is, even if it's Toledo, which I would guess is a bottom half city in Ohio if we rank the list top to bottom. And Cincinnati is definitely above Toledo. I'll say that.
Yeah, Cincinnati's above Toledo and Cleveland.
Okay. Where do y'all have Columbus in the ranking?
I love Columbus. Columbus, I mean, no offense to the – I know a lot of people probably don't like the Ohio State Buckeyes, but I think Columbus is a great time. Columbus is definitely ahead of Cleveland.
Man. Yeah, Columbus is fine. I'd rank Cincinnati ahead of Columbus, honestly. Columbus is fine. It doesn't do much for me.
Okay. So both of you have Cincinnati near the top. You guys won't say, flat out say, if Cincinnati is number one, but it is near the top.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to bring that up. That was really bothering me when I watched the promo of the NFL draft. And I want to say Cleveland is not the greatest city in Ohio. And then I'm done with my rant. We move on. We're a week out from the NFL draft. Plenty of content online at Cincinnati.com. Tyler, Charlie, what is up there?
Yeah, so Duke Tobin spoke to the media yesterday. I have a story on his feelings about Joe Burrow and how they're both optimistic that he will be available for week one. And he also touched on the offensive line, the state of the offensive line right now. And he said the Bengals aren't done addressing the O-line. So I'll have a story coming up on his comments about that later.
I have the Bengals day two NFL draft guide. It's, I guess, my very, very, very small contribution to the Sewell versus Chase debate, because if the Bengals take one of those in the second round, they'll have a glaring lead on day two. We'll have in-depth scouting reports, breakdown intel on probably about 25 prospects total that the Bengals could select.
Make sure you check it out, Cincinnati.com. We do have a Bengals Beat podcast extra with Jeff Schwartz when he talks everything offensive linemen. Thank you for listening to the Bengals Beat podcast. We are back on the Bengals Beat podcast. I'm here with Jeff Schwartz. He's one of my offensive line experts. So, you know, the NFL draft less than 3 weeks away. How you doing, Jeff?
I am good. I'm excited for the draft. And we have drama. And so it's always fun this time of year to talk about where guys are going to go. And even though we kind of know one and two, we definitely don't know three. I don't think we don't know four or five. So there's a lot of drama. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Now in Cincinnati, and honestly, ever since the day they drafted Joe Burrow, everyone's saying protect your quarterback. Unfortunately, he dealt with an injury in the 10th game of his rookie career. And you look at the Cincinnati Bengals, they're at 5 right now. And I think it's a perfect spot. And if you're in Cincinnati, the argument right now is Penei Sewell or Ja'Marr Chase. I know you're a Sewell guy. Tell me why.
Well, I think the upside that he provides is very unique for the position. So, you know, when you draft an offensive tackle this early in the draft, most of the time, you know, they're pretty polished, right? There's upside to be had there, but you're kind of getting what you get. For example, Tristan Wirfs comes to the NFL last year. He was actually the fourth of the four tackles taken early in that draft. And he came in and played right tackle, and he looked like the guy kind of people thought he would be, right? And that's obviously an all pro. He played really well. The thing about Penei is, he's only 20, so he'll play his first snap for the Bengals if he's drafted by the Bengals at 20 years old. He'll actually play like four games while he's still 20. And there's just so much potential upside with him. Is he as polished as Rashawn Slater? No, especially in pass protection. But his attitude, his physicality, his work ethic, and it's all going to get better. His body, he posted a picture of himself shirtless the other day, and it's like, it's a 20-year-old body still. Like, doesn't have muscle definition. Like, it's crazy. He's got so much room for growth because of his age. And we rarely see that at that position. You know, if you get a guy like Rashawn Slater, great pass protector already, right? Like, you have it's there. Right. And that's just with Penei, there's just so much room for growth that if you're willing to put the time into it, and it might take 8 weeks, I don't know how long it might take to get a more polished in pass protection. Bengals have a good offensive line coach. That's the unique part about him. There's just so much room to get better.
You mentioned he's 20 years old and just a young rookie. What the Bengals, if they do decide to draft him at number 5, what are some of your biggest concerns for him in his rookie year?
People use the word immature. I mean, he's 20. What is that? Of course, like we were all 20, but I don't think he's immature for a football player. I think for him, it's just pass protection, right? In college, he just didn't get a lot of true pass protection reps. And I think his hands, and I actually went back and watched him today for this other project I'm doing more closely. And again, like the eighth time, he knows more things with his hands, just misses with his hands at pass pro. What makes him special though, is that he misses with his hands and still wins the rep because he's so good at recovery. He's so athletic. Guys get him in a weird spot, and for a lot of us, we'd fall down, we'd fall over, we'd be pushing the quarterback, but his ability to reset his hips and finish the block is so imagine if he got better at just the starting point of a pass protection rep, not being good already at the finish, right? Like that. So that to me is what you worry about with him. You don't worry about his preparation, his physicality, the way he run blocks. But I think pass more than look, he's just got to play slower at the second level. He tries to kill linebackers, and that's something that really at 20, you don't like know any better. I mean, he's just, he's so, I cannot stress this enough. Like the youth of Panay and the talent is very rare together. And like, he doesn't even know yet, you know, just like how to harness his physicality to his benefit. Cause he hits a second level, he narrows his base and tries to kill dudes because that's what he thinks he has to do. Right. Like that's, and you know, Frank Pollock will be like, hey, just, you don't have to do that. You don't just block the guy, right? Like just block the guy. And so those are things I worry about with him, but they're not like, they're not deal breakers.
We'll go to Rashawn Slater, because I think you look in a lot of mock drafts early on, and even now, even Daniel Jeremiah, he'll have Rashawn Slater ahead of Panay. What do you think people like about Rashawn Slater where he could be a top tackle in the draft?
Yeah, I think for DJ and for a lot of teams, it's the kind of certainty of Rashawn Slater. I'm not saying that Panay is uncertain, but when you get Rashawn Slater, you know right now he can pass protect, which is really important, obviously, in the National Football League. You know, you're going to pass the ball so many times that being able to drop back pass, and he had that game against Chase Young, right? Now, Panay has played multiple guys who have been drafted. That's kind of a thing that I hear people say, well, he hasn't played anyone. That's just not true. And if you include this year, Joe Tryon, the Washington defensive end, they're saying has a first-round grade, maybe late, you know, early second-round grade. He's played four guys in 2019 that are in the NFL. And so Rashawn is just a very smooth pass protector. I think that elevates him, you know, in some people's minds over Panay. Physically, in the run game, you know, Panay kind of has the edge on Rashawn. Rashawn's got to work on the timing of his hips and hands kind of coming through the block, especially in the second level. But he's super athletic. He's super bright. And there's a lot to like about him. I'm just saying that, you know, his Panay's potential, if he puts it all together, and this is no slight to Rashawn Slater, right? Rashawn could still come in the NFL and be an all pro and be the, but like Panay has that special generational potential.
Who could you, not even hate playing this game, because I felt like we did this a lot with Joe Burrow last year before he was
even drafted. It's the worst game ever, but people love it.
I've got to do it because it's a comparison game. If you could compare him to anybody in the NFL right now when it comes to Sewell, who would you compare him to?
Trent Williams, number one, and Joe, a little bit of Joe Staley with the athleticism and the size. Like he's not a, it's not even 6'5", I think. I mean, he was a 6'4" and seven, something like that. 6'0" 4'7". I believe was his official height at the pro day. So he's not a big guy. And you know, the tenacity in the run game is Trent Williams. His ability to finish on the move in the run game is Trent Williams. You know, the Trent Williams is a big kind of heavy handed puncher in pass protection. That when Panay is good, he's a heavy handed puncher in the pass game. And those two guys, I think just the mentality, you know, Trent Williams is the best guy on the move blocking. I think if you look at this draft class, Panay in the second level, when he's not squared up on linebackers, he's really good. Like when he's out in the screens, out on the edge, out leading reverses. That reminds me a lot of Trent Williams.
If the Cincinnati Bengals do what you don't think they should do, and they go wide receiver at number five, and you look in the second and third round, get your offensive lineman, who should they get in the second round? They would be drafting early.
Yeah, I mean, if Brady Christensen is still around from BYU, that would be great, a great get for them. I'm trying to think of who, let's see, there's this, oopsie. Sorry, one second. There's a lot of dogs here. Brady Christensen, if he's there, would be a fantastic get from BYU. I'm trying to think of who would still kind of be there, because there is kind of this, like, there's a couple right tackles to him, which, look, Jenkins probably not going to be there from Oklahoma State. You could draft him, put him at right tackle, put Jonah at left tackle. And, you know, the thing that Bengals fans don't seem to understand about the Riley Reiff signing, it's a one-year deal, and they paid him backup money. They gave him $7 million a year. That's not starter money, guys. Now, he might start for you guys, but that's not like I have to play him money. That's what, you know, Mike Remmers got to be the backup of Kansas City. Like, that's not starter money in the NFL to play left tackle. So the idea that you don't need to draft a left tackle because Riley Reiff is there, that doesn't make any sense. That's not how teams build their rosters. And, you know, so there's – I don't think Jenkins will be there. Darrisaw obviously won't be there. I mean, maybe – but I think if Christensen's there in the second round, Walker Little – Walker wasn't playing in 2 years. He might be early to draft. Is like 30 – what do you think? Is 37 too early to draft Walker Little? Duke Nemeth won his medical service.
I love that we have Duke Manyweather there too.
Yeah, Duke Manyweather is. We're talking early second round tackles. Brady Christensen. Yeah. So yeah, if Brady's there from BYU, super athletic. We saw his pro day. One of Duke's guys, like off the charts. Sam Cosby from Texas. I don't like him as much as others do. I think he just needs to work on his physicality. And so if you want him to start right away, he's probably not a guy that. And that's the benefit of having Riley there, right? You can kind of work in a young guy, but it feels increasingly unrealistic to take a player early in the draft, and that includes a second round, and think they're not going to play early. Like we keep doing this thing where we say, like, even for quarterbacks, oh, you know, we're going to let him. It's very rare now where quarterbacks, I mean, the Pat Mahomes, Alex Smith thing is so rare. The idea that you can bring in a guy in the second round at tackle, and he can just sit for 8 weeks. The premium is to play him now while he's cheap and like get him going. And so I think if they draft someone early in the second round to play that position, he's going to play right now.
I think when you look at the offensive line right now, say they do your plan, they get Panay at five, you add him in there, you have Riley Reiff for 1 year, and then you have Jonah Williams coming back. He's doing just fine in his rehab in California. Trey Hopkins, more than likely, or Billy Price will be the center to start week one. What do you think of that offensive line?
It's a really good offensive line. I think in that case, I'd actually be kind of curious if Riley Reiff would go inside and play guard. People have always said Jonah should move inside. If you know, put Riley at left maybe and Panay at right and Jonah inside. I kind of think you put Jonah and Panay at tackle and you put Riley inside and you let Riley figure it out, which kind of I'd be a piss if I were him and go play guard at his career and level of his career. But he's kind of just like a grinder. I think he would embrace the challenge to be able to do that. But that's a good offensive line. Look, it doesn't have to be the best offensive line in the NFL. You just can't get Joe Burrow killed. Like that's the goal, right? And then you grow into it. You add pieces each year. Look at the Buffalo Bills. They're a great example. The Buffalo Bills have done a great job of building up their offensive line by just kind of taking shots on different guys each year and kind of finding which guy fits. You don't have to build this, you know, you don't have to be the Cowboys and have these, you know, three Hall of Famers in your offensive line to be the best in the NFL. They didn't win any Super Bowls, right? Just get an offensive line that can make sure Burrow doesn't get killed.
Yep. Speaking of Joe Burrow, and I bothered you a couple months ago, the comparison with Herbert and Burrow, because that's going to be there for the rest of their careers.
Yes.
You had a small sample size for Joe Burrow. It was only 10 games, and obviously a lot of talk was the offensive line. What did you take from Burrow's rookie year?
It was good. I was worried at LSU that it was quote unquote easy for him, because when you go empty protection as much as they went empty protection like 70% of the time, which is absolutely outrageous. Like at any level of football, that's crazy. So empty protection means you have five offensive linemen blocking and five receivers in the route. Well, the reason why that's great at any level, if you can execute, is the defense has to show itself, right? Because you've spread your offense out now. The defense has to spread out as well. So if you're a quarterback sitting in the pocket, pre-snap, sitting, you know, and you're in shotgun, you're like, oh, well, two-eye safety. You can't cheat in empty protection if you're the defense, because the field's too wide, especially in college with the hash mark. So if you're in the left hash and you're spread everyone out. The defense has to show you what's happening now. And it's a really huge advantage for the quarterback, especially in college when, you know, you turn the sidelines, the coach tells you a new play with 10 seconds left, they know what's happening. So I was worried that when he got in the NFL, it's not going to be that easy. That's how the NFL is. But I thought he adapted really well. He was a gamer, man. He played. And I think, you know, the intangible stuff like the it factor and kind of playing well when you're losing and playing when things aren't going well, those are, I think, get overlooked and they're hard to quantify. But he had those. I think he played really tough when things weren't going well for him. He kept battling. Obviously, he had the long touchdown run. What week? I forget. Was that week two or three when he had that long touchdown run to the end of the game. He played well.
No, and I know this time of year is a busy time for you and you're all offensive line when it comes to the Cincinnati Bengals. To be determined, nobody knows in Cincinnati if they are going to go offensive line with that number five pick. I know you're busy 3 weeks from the draft. Where can fans find you?
Yeah, at Jeff Schwartz on Twitter, and then my podcast, Jeff Schwartz is Smarter Than You. We had Dan Brugler on from The Athletic, and he had a 267-page scouting report he just dropped, which is incredible. I don't mind pimping out his go to athletic.com and it's well worth it. It's incredible. So we had him on and we talked about the draft and we had a whole subject about what the Bengals should do at five. And I don't know how you take a wide receiver when all the data has showed you that you find a wide receiver in the second or third round. And how often is the first wide receiver taken in the draft, the best wide receiver in that class? The NFL is not built on, you know, winning is not built on whether you have a great wide receiver or not. It really isn't. They're great accessories to have, but you better make sure everything else is buckled up first.
That's a good quote. And I'm sure a lot of Cincinnati Bengals fans would agree with you. Thank you again for joining us.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon when the season starts.
Bye.